The connection. Hopefully.
Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome to the March 18th, 2019 meeting of the Chelan Public Utility District Commission. I'd like to thank everyone for coming today, and a reminder, please, that if you have any electronic devices, including cell phones, if you would please silence them at this time. Today's meeting is both a study and a business session, with the study session starting this morning at 10 o'clock, and the afternoon business session will be starting at 1 o'clock. We expect to have a short session today. General Manager Steve Wright has indicated that the material might flow in, the business session might flow into the study session this morning, given our day.
Don't make promises you can't keep.
I'm sure we can screw that up.
We'll see what we can do with that, Randy. We welcome public input, although I don't see any public at the meeting this morning, but we welcome public input at our meetings and remind you that our meetings are recorded. That if you wish to address any item on the agenda, that you would step up to the microphone, please state your name and your address, and if you'd be kind enough to limit your comments to 3 minutes, that would be appreciated. Today we have all five commissioners present. Also attending is General Manager Steve Wright, Assistant General Counsel Charles Von Reese, and Clerk of the Board Rebecca Garfin. So if you would please at this time join me in a Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. We have a safety moment.
We do, and so part of a one of the things that we're changing here as we think more about safety is we've revamped safety meetings under Tim Pettit's leadership. And one of the things we want to do is try to bring in more things that are relevant and going on at the PUD as we address safety message. Today will be an opportunity to do that. We're going to be reviewing the safety message that was delivered to employees at the February meetings. And then we're going to come back next meeting and talk about what we'll be delivering at the next round of meetings, next round of safety meetings, that you'll be seeing that. So with that, I want to invite Jeremy Jordan to come on up. He was responsible for delivering this message to employees at this last round of meetings, so he's going to do a summary of what was presented to employees.
Thanks. So an exciting message that I got to share this month. It's a little different than our normal safety meeting. And as you know, we've had a change in leadership, and Tim's invited us as a team to really talk about what is our vision for safety? How is it different as we're moving forward? So I get to give you a little bit of a shortened version of what we talked with employees this month about. There are four elements that we shared about our vision and safety. And the first is this idea that how does it fit with the idea of safety compliance, something that's very popular in the United States for the last 30 years. Two parts that we say complement compliance are safety's personal nature and the promise that we make as a district. And then I finished up our talk with employees this month using a case study from a facility called Tom Sock in Missouri. Won't get to talk entirely through that case study with you today, but I'll touch some highlights. This is a picture of Rock Island Dam being built in 1930. And one of the interesting artifacts that you may have seen floating around the district in the last 70 years, this one, it's a log of lost time incidents from 1930 that involved employees as they were building the dam. Over 145 different incidents in that year. And one of the tragic details that you see in this log is that four of those were fatalities. Interestingly, they're pretty well evenly spread throughout the year. And so what we can see there, what we can deduce is that those fatalities and this huge number of incidents really didn't slow work down at the dam in Rock Island in 1930. As a safety department, this log is really a great picture of safety compliance to us and where it came from. There was a time not that long ago in the United States where we had a philosophy that said when you're doing big, difficult work like building a dam, people getting hurt and killed is just part of what you do. That's part of business. And it wasn't long after this log in the next 20 years that we had a big change of heart as a country. We said, no, in fact, that's not the case. We believe that you have to protect people, and in fact, that death is something that you can avoid. Injury is something that you can avoid. And so that's really where safety compliance came from. That's where OSHA came from. And so as a district, what we're saying as part of our philosophy is that compliance is not the end state. It's not something that we're shooting for. It's a first step on a long journey that we have to accomplish. So compliance is really our first step, not our last. We liken it to a metaphor of putting on your seatbelt when you're driving your car. When you, science tells us when you put your seatbelt on, you take a quantum leap forward in protecting yourself if you get in an accident. But it would be truly strange to say, I can put that on and now I can forget about driving safe. There's a whole bunch more that comes after putting that seatbelt on to ensure your safety. So safety compliance is not our entire philosophy. And so a big part of what we talk about this month is what really is. We believe, first off, that safety, to be effective, has to be deeply personal. And by being personal, science tells us that having rules, and especially having safety cops, really doesn't work. This idea that we put in a bunch of rules and we go out and we give infractions when people aren't following them, that works about as long as you're out there to watch folks. And it never really gets at the heart of the issue, never really gets them to believe what it is that you're asking them to do. So as a safety department, we believe that there's something greater, and that is that each and every employee that shows up for work on a daily basis has something that we call their personal why. There's a deep personal reason that they're coming here, that they're showing up. As a department, over the next year, we want to talk about what our personal whys are and start that conversation. And I get to be one of the first ones to do that with you all today. It's been fun to share my why. This is mine, my lovely wife, Sharon, and I've got 4 kids, ages 6 months to 6 years. I call them my circus. They are a ton of fun. They keep me busy. They are smart. They are funny. They are inquisitive. They say things that you never expect. I tell people I love my job here at the PD. It's one of the most unique jobs I've ever had. Incredible people that I get to work with. And showing up for work here every day is a ton of fun. But if I'm being honest, this is the main reason I show up for work. It's protecting these people. And being able to get home to them every night is incredibly important to me. I'd do anything to get home and protect these kids. And so when I talk about my why, there's a reason for that. You know my why now, and it's an invitation that I'm making. And that invitation goes like this. When I'm out working around the district today, tomorrow, or whenever, I'm asking you to help me protect this why. And so if you see me doing something that's not safe, if I've got the wrong shoes, I've forgot my glasses, I'm getting close to an edge, I'm never going to take it personally if you tell me about it, because you're taking this personally with me. You're helping me protect it. This is how safety becomes meaningful. That we protect each other's whys. It's not about rules and regulations. It's about protecting what's most important to us. One of the things that I got to share with employees this month is that's an incredible mission, by the way. Showing up to work as a safety department, knowing that our job is to protect people's whys, that's incredibly empowering. It's something that we're excited about. There's a second piece to this vision, and that's our 4 values. And I know we're all intimately familiar with those in this room. One of the things that we've shared this month, though, is that the order to us is very significant. We've put safety first. There's a lot of really great organizations in the world today that do not have safety as one of their 4 values. And so that's a message we're sending when we say that it is. And not only is it part of our values, it's our first value. And so as a safety team, we think that really that is a promise we're making. And the promise goes something like this. Our employees give us our minutes. They give us their hours, their days, their weeks, their months, their years. And as I've shared in many meetings this month, a lot of our employees give decades, which is pretty incredible. The promise we're making by having safety as our first value is that we will do absolutely everything in our power to get them home to their wives. That we'll bleed, we'll sweat, we'll stay up nights thinking about that. But that's our mission. I think one of the hard things about this message for us that's going to be hard throughout the year is that we failed at that promise last year. And so as a safety team, we're thinking really hard about how to keep it better this year. So one of the things that we've shared with employees is this. We're going to ask them to do some hard things in 2019 and beyond. And what we hope they understand is, as we're doing that, it's not about compliance. It's not because the state of Washington requires us to do that. It's because we have a promise to keep. And we want to take that promise very seriously. So one of the ways that we're doing that is a science. It's called human performance improvement. And there's a whole ton of things to learn about this, and we're going to do that this year as an organization. It all boils down to one really fascinating fact, though, and that fact goes something like this, that every single human being in this room, and in fact on the planet Earth, makes 1 to 7 uncontrollable errors an hour. And as you dig into this science, which has been around since at least World War II, what you find is those errors are often untraceable, that the people making them don't even know they made an error. Normally, they're so small and so insignificant that they don't add up to much. It can be as simple as hitting the wrong keystroke on your keyboard is one of those 7 errors. And if you're like me, you raise the top of that upward limit of errors quite a bit. But what we find when we look at safety incidents throughout history is that those little errors add up sometimes in a way that becomes catastrophic. A series of small errors turns into something much bigger. Our case study this month looked in depth at this. I'm going to give you just a really simple example using what we call a red dot diagram. So the red dots are stakeholders or our public, blue dots are management, and green dots are employees. So one of those blue dots, a manager comes in on a Monday and they're very stressed out. They've got a huge plate of work that they can't accomplish in a week. As they're talking to their foreman, they inadvertently make a mistake. They share some of that stress without meaning to. And so that's their small error for the day. The foreman picks up on that error, picks up on that stress, and says, you know what, I'm going to help my manager out. I'm going to take on the most difficult job on the plate this week and get it off. We're going to tackle it and get it over with. The mistake the foreman makes, their small error, is they don't realize that they only have four senior people available. Their fifth person is out sick that day, but they still decide to take on the job. One of the least experienced employees on the team steps up and says, you know what, I'm going to help out. I will take the fifth person's spot today, and I'll help out with this job. Their error is not realizing they don't have the experience level required to work safely in this particular role. And so they get out, and they start doing that job, and somebody in the public, maybe it's a driver on the street, makes a mistake, interacts with that job in a way that maybe hurts themselves or somebody else on the team. And we have a safety event. Somebody gets hurt, maybe somebody gets killed. In a traditional organization, the first thing that we want to do is we want to go and investigate so we can understand. And I have understanding in quotation marks here because, as we've discovered and as many organizations have discovered, investigation is actually not such a useful way to understand what happened. Because what investigations usually focus on is this last person who made a mistake. We call it the person holding the baton when things go wrong. Human performance improvement instead teaches us to go back and look at this entire incident, starting with the very first error. And in our Tom SOC example that we shared this month, that was in 1960, was that first error that led to a catastrophic event. And understand the entire context of what happened, not so that we can punish somebody who made a mistake, but instead so that we can make sure this never happens to other people in the future. Future-proof ourselves from errors. So two more themes I want to share with you here as I wrap up this morning. We've had the privilege of looking at a whole bunch of safety incidents that have taken place over decades around the world. And there are a couple themes that you learn about that are pretty fascinating. The first one is what I call the theme of sorrow. And over again, as you talk to people who are involved in these safety incidents, what you hear again and again and again is that they often had some kind of a gut feeling before something went wrong. They had a feeling or a tickling in the back of their head that they should stop something. They may not have been sure of what it was, but they knew something was about to go wrong, but they didn't stop it. And so that second theme is then this idea that people would do just about anything to go backwards in time, to listen to that feeling in their gut and to stop work and have a conversation. And of course, at that point, it's often too late. So the key ingredient for human performance improvement is what we're calling the questioning attitude. And it is this willingness to stop things and say, I don't feel really good about what's going on here, and I can't even tell you why, but I'd really love to have a conversation. Or to be willing for a junior person, like the employee I mentioned in this story, to question someone much senior and say, this isn't disrespectful, but I just need to tell you, I don't feel right about this plan. We found over and over again, looking at all these safety incidents, that this is the key ingredient that would most likely have interrupted and maybe even stopped many of them. And so it's going to be a key theme for us this year as we talk about human performance improvement. In our safety meetings, we got to talk about a case study. I've mentioned Tom Sock a couple times. This is a dam and stored water facility in Missouri, at the top of a mountain that blew out in 2005, about 45 years after it was built. This will be posted on our safety website if you'd like to dig in more. The story that we tell, though, is that there are a series of over 36 errors, starting in 1960 with the dam's design, all the way up to the last button push an operator made in December of 2005 that led to that dam blowing up. And so the question that I pose to employees as we walk through this story is, walking through those many errors, who would you blame for the dam exploding? And for $1.5 billion of water going down the hill, and most importantly, for the destruction of a state park where 300 families often stayed overnight. Fortunately, in this particular incident, it was December, and they got very lucky that nobody was hurt. So our invitation to employees this month is that they hold us accountable to what we've said our mission is. And one of the big ways that we believe people can do that is by sharing many of these things they feel uncomfortable about. So putting in a safety concern, shooting us an email, giving us a phone call, letting the safety team know about the things that they'd like us to look at and to solve. Because we're saying that protecting their why is really important. And so I'd make the same invitation to anybody in this room. We would love to have a lot more safety concerns coming in that we can look at and tackle as a safety department, because we believe that's one of our critical functions here in the district. And we also believe that it's a critical measure of health that employees trust us enough to put those things in. So another message that we'll be sharing as we go forward in the coming months. Really appreciate your time, and this is a fun topic. So thanks again for listening.
Thank you.
Good job, Jeremy. That's really powerful.
Yeah, really hits home. Really well done.
And a strong connection to the safety report we got last month about how do we get more things to be put on the table that allow us to address issues before they become an outcome that we're trying to address.
Good direction. Yes. Commissioners, we have before us an agenda. Items can be moved to the consent agenda. Any desire of a commissioner? Do I hear any such desire?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we take item 10 off the regular agenda and item 11 and move them to the consent agenda.
Can I hear a second? Been seconded. And any discussion? Hearing none, we'll go for a vote. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Those opposed, say nay. The ayes have it. Okay.
Just want to check to see, we had a question about item 8, whether you want to consider item 8 on the regular agenda.
Yeah. I think given the size of that particular contract, I think it'd be good to hear to talk about it on the regular agenda. I do.
Okay. All right. We'll plan for that then. We'll plan to have the right people here.
Okay.
Okay, next up, I would like to invite Dan Garrison, Chris Scheimer to come on up. This is a Cycle of Personal Ownership winner for February of 2019. Very interesting event. And actually, I'm going to let Dan talk about this one first because he's closest to it and describe what Chris and Christina Dietering managed to pull off.
Hi, I'm Dan Garrison, Director of Hydro Operations. I submitted two names for this award recognition, Chris Scheimer and Christina Dietering. Just a little bit of background about why. We had a routine fire alarm at Rocky Reach Dam a number of weeks ago. It was on a Friday. And one of our employees during that fire alarm felt very disoriented. And Christina and Chris went to this employee's aid. Chris is a EMT as well, and through his time with this employee said, this needs additional medical attention, made those arrangements, and before that weekend was out, that employee had brain surgery and is recovering extremely well. So this is in recognition for Chris and Christina and their efforts to ensuring a long and healthy life of one of our employees. And Chris, if you want to add to that, your mic is all yours.
Dan, as I thought about that, the only thing that I would really want to call out about the incident was this is one of the people that's on our team, and we work with her all the time. And what really came up out of this was that because we all work together all the time, we noticed something was different. It was very subtle. It progressed over time, and I don't even think that if we were new people on the team or a new crew member, I don't know if we would have caught it, but we've worked with this person for a long time, and it was actually one of the other guys on the crew that's not even really medically trained that said, that's a little different for her. Yeah. It just progressed from there. So I guess my point is we got to keep an eye on each other.
Good for you. Yeah.
So I have a question. Was the patient resistive at all?
Not at all.
Not at all?
That's no, great. She...
That's good.
No. She went right along with what we were saying.
Good job.
Good.
Nice
good
work.
For you.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chris. And if you'd pass along our thanks to Christina as well, I appreciate that. Gary, while we're on the subject of safety and employees taking care of one another, I probably should do this under commission, but it fits in here. The other day I was at talking about the Discovery Center at a meeting and about the new Discovery's Museum Center. And I've always been really interested on the fish on the outside of the building. And I wanted the opportunity to meet Jeremy Payne, the guy that made those, down at Central Maintenance. And I had a lunch break, and so I gave him a call and made some arrangements. And he came up and met me while I was out at Rocky Reach and took me for a tour down at Central Maintenance. And the reason why I mention this is I was really impressed with the cleanliness, the organization, the effort that was being put into safety. Everything was well organized and clean, and that's an area where somebody could leave something laying around, trip hazards, dangerous equipment, and I just was so impressed with what I saw on that tour. Those guys are working hard, and I appreciate how they're taking care of one another, and it was good to see.
Those are good comments, and I'll chime in and say that I was at Rocky Reach myself recently and had the opportunity to look down on the turbine floor from the observation deck. And without any exaggeration, I wouldn't be hesitant to eat my lunch off that floor because it's so clean. And to consider how old that facility is, it's kept in top-notch shape by staff. And they do a great job down there. So that's something really to be proud of, especially considering we do have that observation window and visitors from all over the state and, for that matter, all over the world who come there and look down on that floor all see the same thing that we see, which is just how clean the facilities are, how well kept they are, and that's something we should all be proud of. So good job.
Okay. Thanks. We'll pass that on.
Okay, so next.
All right, next up, we want to do overall substation update. Going to ask Chad Rissman, Andy Wendell to come up. We've got a lot of activity going on with substations, both in terms of addressing growth, but also thinking about how we prepare for the future in terms of technology. So with that, turn it over to the team.
Thank you. Good morning, Commissioners. Good morning. It's good to see you all here together. I'm Andy Wendell, Director of Customer Service.
Chad Rissman, Director of Distribution Engineering and Asset Management.
So I'd say over the last 12 to 18 months or so, we've been here quite a bit talking about load growth and what we're doing to try to get ahead of that. Substations is clearly the key asset that is the backbone of our distribution system. So we appreciate your support in moving forward to acquire the properties to build these substations. So we thought it was appropriate to bring you an update on where we're at, or where we've been, where we're at now, and really where we're going with regard to these substations. So our objective today is just to essentially provide an update to you relative to the infrastructure planning and those property acquisitions. We're not asking for any input today, any decisions, but we'd love to hear your thoughts and field any questions that you might have about where we're at and where we're going.
Just one of the things to mention, too, though, is that early notification. There are going to be things related to this. We wanted to provide a backdrop because there'll be some future resolutions, and we'll identify those through the presentation. That there'll be some future resolutions coming up for purchase and sale agreements and property acquisitions and the like related to this activity.
So you've seen this map in a number of presentations. The green blocks on this particular county map show our existing 34 substations. And as Chad and his engineers have worked through our long-range planning, we've identified that we want to build 14 new substations over the next 20-year horizon. We've talked a lot about that planning process. Generally, each substation is about a three-year process, where the first year is generally property acquisition, a year of design and procurement, and then a year of construction. And so we believe that the most challenging aspect of that is finding the right location and acquiring the properties. So we're very aggressive on these 14 properties. The four that we're going to talk in detail a little bit about today is what we're referring to as the Schlan Dam up north, just adjacent to the Schlan Dam on south of town. Also, in our old station area, there's been activity in the Omi substation adjacent to the Stamilt growers facility. The Wenatchee substation down here on Worthing Street, and then we'll talk a little bit about Mill Pond. As I mentioned, we'd be happy to field questions on any of the properties that outside of these four as well.
So we'll get into this a little bit more in further slides, but just wanted to relate this back to the quarterly load update and identifying the Chelan area and the Wenatchee areas where we're seeing the most load growth. So it's just those are the areas that we're focusing in on to try to identify these locations and determine what infrastructure improvements are going to be needed in those areas. So one of the things that we've been doing starting in 2017 and through 2018 is recognizing our customer expectations and also relating to what Jeremy and the safety group are talking about is we're looking at things quite a bit differently. And we're wanting to build for the future. We wanted to keep options open. We want to ensure that our reliability is always improving. And in order to do that, we need to review the operations, the maintenance, and the reliability requirements and the spacing, among other things, the innovation that we're building into our substations. We want to review and make sure that we're acquiring and identifying these things in the way that's going to future-proof us and meet our needs down the road. Some of those needs we're not quite sure of yet. So we spent a couple of years evaluating our standard substations and the expectations that we have out of those new builds. So there's some things that came out of that. One of them is that our footprint, we want our footprint to be a little bit bigger. This is showing Walla Walla Substation that was built 2008 time frame. Gosh, can't be that long ago. But 2008 time frame, and we were moving down that path where you can tell we've got a future slide in here that we want to be able to build another substation inside here. So we're using the same footprint, utilizing the same property. And I think we've heard sentiments like that from the board. Let's acquire the property that we need in order to expand and meet the future needs. So this is an example of that. But it's also an example that we think we not quite there yet in terms of acquiring the needed square footage for what we think might be our ultimate plans within the station, making sure that we can meet tomorrow's reliability expectations. So we'll get into that just a little bit.
I would just add that generally speaking, we're looking for those properties that are around that 300 by 300. But one of the things that we recognize is that there's a variety of different property options out there that may be different in size, and sometimes it may be a 5-acre parcel or a different shape parcel. It does take time. We bring it back to Chad's engineering team to do some preliminary alignment. But generally speaking, we're looking for that 300 by 300, which is almost twice the space that our traditional substations are at. That's a bit of a challenge to find, you know, a 300 by 300 piece, say in the city of Wenatchee that is, graded appropriately, and ready to go. So, it's not as easy as it looks.
I want to talk a little bit about, expanding in on the idea of expansion capabilities, operations and maintenance within the substations. On the outside, other than the footprint, a lot of things really look the same. There's steel and the two major pieces of equipment that are in there. And to that extent, the transformer really hasn't changed. Our voltages haven't changed. But behind the curtain, a ton of things have changed. And for the most part, there are many components in these stations that are really not the same. There's a lot more, we need a lot more time to go into some of the details, but I just wanted to highlight some of the few things that we're considering, not just the footprint, but also the things that are going on within the station that are improving and advancing our capabilities there with respect to reliability. And reliability, we really need to meet. When we break reliability down, it really comes to what's our expansion capabilities, what is our maintenance capabilities, what's our repair capabilities, and how much do we know about these assets and the conditional assessments of these assets as they're going through time. So it's really related. All those things are really relating and supporting reliability. So just a few bullet points here, some of the things that we're advancing and have advanced within the stations are advanced SCADA controls and data acquisition. When I first started here a few years ago, we were hardwiring everything. So everything required a copper wire from the information that it was going to collect to the receiver, then to go to system operations. Today, that wire doesn't exist. There's a blue hose. I like to call it blue hose, but there's an Ethernet connection that is connecting up all of these intelligent devices. And we have the capability to collect tens of thousands of data points from each one of these locations now. It's all sitting there ready. It's ready for, we're utilizing a number of things. We're bringing in to our system operators in most locations over 200 data points for them to be continuously processing. So, and then there's thousands more that have the capability and they're ready to be turned on when we start applying things like outage management systems and AMI to complement what's going on in the system. So there's a number of things that are going on there. Advanced relaying capabilities. We used to have electromechanical relays that are essentially built on the same technology of the meter with the spinning disc. That was essentially our protective relays. When that disc spun fast, that's when we had a trip or breaker. All that's gone away for the most part for the new technologies. We still have some of it that's out there in our system, but we're using these computerized software driven computers to help us understand more about what's going on in the system so we can improve reliability and safety. But some environmental and fire standards. So we've deployed, there's oil, thousands of gallons of oil in these transformers, and we don't want that to go anywhere in the event of a spill or a failure. So there's additional requirements that we're doing for both compliance and for our own needs to be able to contain that oil on the site. So if you're a neighbor, we want to make sure that that oil is not going anywhere but on the site, and we have the ability to clean it up. So there's some environmental enhancements, improvements that we've been making there too. Oh, thank you for pointing that out, Andy. One of the things that we're working a lot on right now is our wiremen, our Holly Street or our substation power system wiremen. Their skills, knowledge, and abilities and their capabilities are changing dramatically as things inside the substation are changing. We're using less hammers and more laptops today. And there's an evolution that's happening faster than I would have anticipated with our wireman group. There's a lot more advanced training. They're becoming closer and closer to what looks more like a technician rather than a wireman carrying a tool belt. Now, there's all those things that the hard, heavy construction type stuff that goes on in the substation. But there's this new element of all this technology that's going on inside the station. So trying to advance the capabilities of the wiremen and understand how that's evolving and changing that workforce is really something that we're going to be working on in the next few years. So look forward to bringing more of that to the board. So a little bit more on the expansion capabilities, operation and maintenance that supports reliability and ultimately means lights on for longer and more reliable for our customers. Andy can Photoshop faster than we can build, but he He's great at the these illustrations. But you can see in here, this is Walla Walla again, what we showed earlier. We had the idea in mind here, and the board supported us of acquiring additional property so that we could expand. So this is a great example of showing that we can go from a single bank to a double bank. But what we didn't really think about and what pointed out in the 2017-2018 capability review of our substations is that that's great, but we can't get the mobile in there now.
That's what I was going to have.
Right? So we really tied up our mobile capabilities, and so we found ourselves in a spot where, well, does that mean that we could take one of these things offline? Well, we want to be able to load these things up. We don't want to have stranded assets in here. We want to make sure that we're fully utilizing these assets. Well, if we're fully utilizing them, then that means if we want to perform maintenance, which we know we need to do, it means we have to take half of the substation down. Well, that's not going to meet our needs. So we got to make sure that we bring these mobile substations in there. I just want to make a little bit of a plug for our mobile substations as we're reviewing our substation requirements and our build capabilities. We're understanding that these mobile substations are very critical to the reliability and to our operations and maintenance. So we're going to be bringing some recommendations and some reviews about our mobile fleet, and we're understanding that we probably want to make some adjustments in that area, so we'll bring those things to the board for your review. So you can see there's some additional property. So going back to the additional slide there, not only was this great for expansion, but now all of a sudden for operations and maintenance, maybe still not there.
Okay, we'll shift gears a little bit. I think you've seen this particular slide in one form or another in previous presentations. Just moving from the top down, the stations that we've acquired properties, the North Shore, Lake Chelan, Leavenworth, the OME Old Station, and late last year acquired the property in Eniat. We're essentially going through primarily design in each one of those, and we'll talk a little bit about what stage of that design. But I think it's safe to assume that construction would follow kind of the same list, if you will. Some of the properties right there in the middle, the Wenatchee downtown, the Chelan Dam or the Gorge, and the Mill Pond in Malaga, and those are three active pieces of property that we either were looking at acquiring property or we have acquired property. And then the ones on the bottom, the Cashmere West, the Mission Ridge or the Upper Squilchuck, the Howard Flats, the Dry Lake in the Manson vicinity, and the Rock Island Dam. These are additional substations that we know that we want to build within that 20-year spectrum. But from a loading standpoint, they're not the highest priorities. But based on growth and expansion, they could move up or down on that list appropriately.
So Andy mentioned this a couple of times. I just wanted to highlight this. Is really appreciate the board's support in identifying these locations and acquiring these sites. And then we can monitor what our actual growths are, and we can speed up and slow down because of the site acquisition piece. It's important to the community that we are working with them and to the board that we're working together to try to identify these. And some of them are more complicated than others. Some of them have more sensitivities than others. So I really appreciate being able to look 20 years out and actually take actions on here and sort of cue these locations up and wait for the load growth or opportunities to drive the actual construction schedule. So I appreciate the support there.
Okay, so we'll start with the North Shore substation. I think it's being referred to as the Boyd Station. And have you finalized on a name on it?
No, what we're sometimes what makes a lot of sense in the public space doesn't necessarily make sense in the operations space. So thinking we might have some aliases, what makes sense from a location standpoint, for example, Chelan Dam, that might turn into an operational name that changes later. And the reason is it's we're wanting to make sure that it doesn't sound like something else so that when we're having communications over the radio about switching, that there's a very good distinction some of those names might not make sense. So we're playing around with the names a little bit to make sure that we're coordinating with the operations group.
So Commissioner Conyon, we're soliciting names for the North Shore substation.
That's great. In your area.
Good. Essentially, all the property and the easements have been finalized on that particular site, and we're working through a general arrangement, that standard arrangement of the equipment in the yard. But also, we recognize that the community in that immediate area is very interested and participated in some of the landscape architecture, for lack of a better term, where we'll be able to take a look at a variety of different ways to minimize both lighting and noise and just the aesthetic appearance of that station in that view corridor.
Jump in here, Andy. Yeah. So how far is this substation off Boyd Road? Maybe a half a mile, would you say, where you turn up Henderson off Boyd?
Maybe a little bit less. Yeah, probably.
Somewhere in that range.
So really, maybe we need to, we can talk. Henderson Road substation. Henderson, yeah. I don't know. No, but that's a good point. So it's very clear to the folks who need to figure out where it is in a prompt way, you know.
Well, yeah, names mean a lot. Mm-hmm. A lot more than I think we recognize. It triggers something in everybody's mind. Whether you're an operator is a different perspective, or if you're somebody that lives on Boyd Road, is going to think about Boyd Road substation different than Henderson Road substation, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So there is a lot of importance.
There is.
So to summarize, at this particular location, the general arrangements have been done. I think it's probably in the area of a 60% layout. We're at the point, though, where we can start scheduling that community involvement in the landscape design process. We anticipate launching that in and around the June timeframe, and we visited most even recently with a handful of people that are very interested in participating in that. So it'll be a great learning opportunity for us as well. Again, targeting construction and the year 2020 for that particular station. Looking west to Leavenworth, that property has also been acquired and the easements are acquired. We do own a little bit more than this particular view. Looks like we do take in that home. And as the engineering team is working through that, kind of that final arrangement of the equipment, we'll have a much better understanding of what properties we need and maybe have an opportunity to relinquish portions of that property as well. I think for all practical purposes in this particular view, the substation is would be located in that bare ground area, where my cursor is at. Again, there too, there's a group of community members that are interested in participating in the landscape design or the exterior of the substation, again, to remediate any kind of a lighting or aesthetics concerns that they and the property owners adjacent may have. And so we'll also be performing that community outreach portion in the year 2019. Very similar to North Shore, we are targeting construction in 2020 for the station as well. OMI substation, as you know, we worked with the adjacent property owners, the Milt, to acquire this station. And as we began the general arrangement, as Chad had mentioned, we wanted to incorporate that new standard, that new footprint where we can put a dual power transformer in addition to the mobile substation in. So this is what it originally looked like. The neighboring property to the north is in red, and then the blue existing substation property that we had. As the engineers laid out that new alignment, we quickly realized that we could use more property, or we need more property to achieve that preferred standard today. You can see that that preferred standard would bleed into that neighboring property to the north by about 40 feet. So we've engaged that neighboring property owner, and they're willing to work with us to secure that additional space. we've put together a list of the additional work to to manage that, because as you'll see in the next photos, it is on a bit of a slope. But we do need to build an engineered retaining wall of about 4 foot by 300 foot. And there's quite a bit of soils removal, excavation, and removal that would need to happen to bring that grade down to a functional site. So that work combined with the additional property is right in that $300,000 range. As Chad mentioned, we'll be bringing back a recommendation for an approval on that acquisition.
Is that an existing fence behind those trucks?
Yes, there's an existing fence there. We'll move to the next photos so you can kind of see that. Again, this is that general arrangement that Chad had talked about, that preferred standard. And the dash line, the red line at the top, would be the existing property line. So theoretically, it could be squeezed in there. But for fire protection and access, we do need that additional space.
So maybe I could just point out one of the biggest differences here. So here at the bottom is where we plan on the mobile coming in and driving through in this area. You can see that if we cut that out, we would be able to move both these transformers back, and it would look a lot more like Walla Walla. That's the biggest change that we made, is recognizing that we really still need to bring this mobile substation in there in order to provide the expansion capabilities and the reliability that we know that our customers expect. So
two of those.
Excuse me? Mobiles. We have one that is flagged not use. So we have three mobiles total. We have one that is flagged not use. We just have that reserved for emergency conditions. We've identified some problems with it. We have another one that's fairly new. I forget which year, but within the last 6-7 years that we've bought a new one. And it is fully capable of providing a backup for almost all of our substations. And then we have another one that's been rebuilt, originally 1950s, and it's half the size, roughly, of what our typical substation is. So it's very limited in where we can put it. So really, when you look at our fleet, we have one mobile substation that's capable of going into each or any of our substations. We have another that can only go into a few. So we want to reevaluate that and bring some options back to the board and take a look at that. So you can see that's where the biggest difference is. Now, we were working with and moved forward on this property acquisition while we were evaluating what our needs are. So now we're coming back and saying, shoot, we need to do something a little bit different here, and we would like your support in hopefully expanding out the yard. So
if I can interrupt, just can we go back?
Sure.
One slide. So when you bring a mobile in, does the mobile itself physically have to be on either side, or can it function being just on one side but perhaps servicing the furthest one out? What's the distance that it has to be?
It can be in either side.
Either side.
Yep. So we have temporary cables that we lay down on the ground from the mobile, and we can go to either side, either station.
Yeah. I think in some arrangements that I've seen, the mobile sub could potentially go right down the middle of the two, spread them out, more space in between, or more space on one set or the other set.
Okay. So the whole idea here is we're trying to figure out, how do we perform the critical maintenance and the conditional assessments on these very important assets? And we do that without taking an outage. That's real reliability to our customers. So we don't want to build something that we can't maintain. That ends up being something that's run to failure, and we don't believe that that meets the reliability expectations of the board or our customers. A little bit more detail on what this looks like. Unfortunately, this is a bit of a sloped area where we want to expand in. So that $300,000 or thereabout in the neighborhood, we did not plan that in the budget. So we'll be looking at that. The station, the whole station itself, is about $3.5 million that's in the budget. So this is, you know, potentially about 10% or less of the total project budget, which will eat into the contingency. So we're not anticipating a major budget increase, but it is additional work that we recognize we recommend doing. As Andy mentioned, the bulk of the estimate for what would be required would be building a 4 to 5 foot retaining wall and removing, I think it's about 1,000 yards of or so of soil, 1,200 yards maybe. There's a lot of soil and rock and debris to move out of there, so that's where the majority of that estimate is. Any questions on OMI before we move on to the next one?
So Wenatchee Substation, as you recall, we took a look around the city and we just could not identify a location that was either cost effective or suitable for our expansion of the electric system in the downtown corridor. And so we continually kept coming back to our existing substations. They're located on Worthen Street to say, what could we do to arrange and achieve kind of that dual power transformer with the mobile sub access? Through that analysis, we identified that the property to the north would be ideal to acquire. This is the section that's has the blue arrow, the piece on your right. So we've been working with that property owner for some time. Late last week, we did secure the property under a purchase and sales agreement with the anticipated closing around the June 1st timeframe. We still have a bit of feasibility work to do there, and we'll continue to do our due diligence on that property. But as of now, it looks like we're going to be able to move forward with expanding the Wenatchee substation to from its existing 30 megawatt power transformer to a total of 56 in there with two power transformers.
So one of the things that's going on with Wenatchee, I hesitated when I was talking about the mobile and where that can fit in. Wenatchee's one of our only stations that is actually bigger. The power transformer is bigger than it's a 33 MVA rather than a 28 MVA, and our mobile's only a 25. Our new larger one's only a 25 MVA. So conceivably, if this was fully loaded, the Wenatchee area, and there was an issue with it, and we couldn't transfer over to nearby stations, we wouldn't be able to pick up all load. That doesn't meet our expectations. So applying our new standard to this station would mean replacing this 133 with two 28s and going and applying our new standard. So this property, based on the feasibility work that we did, would be adequate for us to apply the new standard with the 228s, and that would be more consistent with what the size of our mobile substation is. So.
Is that 33 reaching end of life?
Yes, it's an older station, one of our older stations, and I'm trying to remember the year, and it's a 70s vintage, if I recall correctly. We have a conditional assessment on that, and it's towards the bottom of the list in terms of end of life, and it's higher on the list for replacement.
The Chelan Dam substation, again, Commissioner Kong, we're seeking input on names for the substations. Actually got some great feedback from customers on various names as well. As you know, last week it was Wednesday on the 13th, we had kind of our first introduction to the public, and we had that in two forms. We put together a list of stakeholders where around 20 attendees came to a luncheon where we walked through two projects, one project being the construction of a new substation with a corresponding transmission line, and the other project was the introduction of the reliability improvements that have been recommended to do on the transmission line that moves power from the Chelan Falls area up to the Manson area and all of the connecting substations. That particular initial reliability or fire hardening, as we're calling it, from Chelan Falls to Union Valley Substation was presented to the community. To to our delight, there was significant support for that reliability project, rebuilding the transmission line from Union Valley back down to Chelan Falls, replacing the existing wood poles with steel poles. Chad Bowman and his team were there giving the presentation, and it was very well received. Our next steps on that are to start reaching out to the individual property owners that those transmission lines work on to make sure that they understand our desires, and we're going to be seeking feedback on that. I do anticipate bringing back, if you're interested, bringing back a full report on the community outreach for both the substation transmission line that connects the substation as well as the reliability project, the fire hardening project. But I thought today I'd just kind of give you a peek in the bag of what we're hearing. With respect to the substation, we spent a considerable amount of time talking both at the luncheon and the drop-in in the evening with folks about kind of the need and the why we needed to build in that particular vicinity. And again, to my delight, it was very well received. People understood the need, and they supported the need. They supported, in general, they supported the location or the general vicinity of the location. As you know, we have not put stakes in the ground as to where the substation would reside, but it's in that first section of the Gorge Road on PUD property. There was a lot of recognition that the PUD did own property in that area, and they do think it's appropriate for us to utilize our property accordingly. So we thought that was great feedback. There was much more interest and discussion around the corresponding transmission lines. And as you know, we presented what we thought were three potential routes, not limiting it to those routes. Excuse me, there were four routes that we discussed at that location. One coming from the existing South Shore substation out of Knapp's Coulee, coming along the South Shore. One coming from the Union Valley substation, and then coming down through town and crossing the gorge. Another one coming from the Chelan substation vicinity that would also come down through the what I would consider industrial area, and then crossing the gorge. And then the fourth option was to bring a transmission line up from Chelan Falls up the Gorge Road, and generally following the Gorge Road, all on the south side of the river there, and connecting to the substation. To a bit of a surprise, but it was essentially both at the luncheon the stakeholder group luncheon that we had, as well as the drop-in. This was open to the public for people to come in. It was virtually unanimous to folks advocating to bring the transmission line from Chelan Falls up to the new substation location using the Gorge Road or the Gorge Route. Interesting enough, people expressed a lot of opposition about crossing the Chelan River with a transmission line. So the coming from the Chelan substation crossing the gorge, and then coming from Union Valley down through town and crossing the gorge, there was significant opposition to that. A lot of support. Interesting enough,
I'm not surprised.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what I've been hearing, but excuse me. So that line from Chelan Falls, you said, would be on the south side of the river. So it would not follow the road, the old gorge road.
Generally, it would follow the old gorge road. There's some sections down toward the Chelan Falls that where we kind of, it would use the terrain to shorten the distance, not following the road exactly mm-hmm. down okay. there. But for the most part, the route that was preferred was following the gorge road from Union
right.
Valley, or excuse me, from Chelan Falls mm-hmm. up to the station location. There was very little input mm-hmm. on the route from the existing substation location on the South Shore, the Knapp's Coulee, coming along the South Shore. But as we indicated to folks that technically it may be very difficult to do that, even if there was advocacy by the community, just because of its long radial aspects of that line. Those were good indicators for us. By no means did we say, okay, let's go head down to the store and buy new steel poles and build up the gorge road. We have a lot more outreach to do. I would add, though, that the Trail Alliance had an opportunity in a couple of venues to weigh in on that, and the Trail Alliance was very expressed support for the substation location, as well as the corresponding transmission line coming up the gorge road as well. We did, prior to the 13th, earlier that week, I think it was the 11th, we had a small team here with our fish and wildlife folks. We met with the city of Wenatchee, the city of Chelan, as well as the Washington State Department of Fish and Wildlife and the Trail Alliance. So it was a small stakeholders group. We wanted to give them an understanding of what we were asking of the public and have a conversation about it. The city expressed support for both the substation and the transmission line, as did the Trail Alliance in that earlier meeting on Monday. Washington State Fish and Wildlife, they had some questions, and they didn't, you know, formally weigh in on where they're at on that. But we do have some folks from our Fish and Wildlife Department that are having direct conversations with them about what the community advocacy was. So we hope to kind of close that gap over the next couple of weeks. That said, it was a very successful outreach project, and we really appreciate hearing from the public on that. By no means are we complete on that, and certainly circle back with you on a kind of final report and a request to move it to the next phase. But early indicators are showing very positive signs in Chelan.
It's a great start.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Good job.
We do have a property down in the Malaga area. It's referred to as the Mill Pond. It's at the base of Stamilt Hill Road, the intersection of Stamilt Creek Road and Malaga Alcoa Highway. This particular property, we've had some extensive feasibility on it. We believe that we want to move forward with property acquisition. We're continuing to work with the property owner on that aspect. We've done a small amount of outreach associated with the property, some of the neighbors, as well as the county, just to look at the feasibilities of it. There's some unique attributes about it, such as the access on the south side of the property is a county road right-of-way. It's called McEldowney Road, and we may need to do some improvements to be able to get the mobile sub into there. So we've been working through that effort as of recently, and we are continuing to work with that property owner as we speak. We hope to bring a recommendation to acquire that property in 2019 with a preferred construction in that 2020-2021 time frame.
Looks like a fairly good-sized piece of property.
It is a little bit of a bigger piece of property. I wish I had a better photo for you, but one thing to note on this particular property is we have a large transmission corridor that kind of runs east-west. In fact, you can see some of the structures vaguely in this photo. There's about four transmission lines that run parallel through that area, again, moving from the east through the west. A couple of strategies there was to try to get enough property that bumps right up against, and in some cases acquires even a portion of that property that we currently encumber through our transmission lines. That's both for the ensuring the connectivity of the new substation with those transmission lines, but also potential future operations in there. As you recall, we've talked about the need to bring a transmission line to a substation in the Upper Squilchuck Valley. And this particular area is one of the potential connection points. The other aspect about that additional property is that getting the power out of this substation is largely going to be bringing the circuits from the substation property, which is located here where I'm moving the cursor, and out to Stamilt Creek Road. And by having those properties again, we're minimizing additional easements and just improves our overall flexibility with that. So it is a bit of a larger parcel that we're looking at. I think at this point in time, it's right in around that 6 acre mark. Am I stating that right, Vicki? Yeah, right around that 6 acre mark. But we'll bring a final resolution and request forward with details about that particular property. One thing that's notable about this is that we will be able to achieve our 300 by 300 foot aspect and maybe a little bit more. So those engineers are smiling about this piece of property without a doubt. Just to note too, one of the county commissioners lives in one of the homes just south on this map. And we've had an opportunity to talk with him as well as the neighbors up there. We've taken that a step forward and took that commissioner to a few of our other substations so they could just get a feel for what they do and what they look like. And we've gotten a lot of support through that effort as well. So. Chet, you want to talk on Blue Star Growers?
Sure. So, Cashmere, as a part of the 2008 purchase and sale agreement that was put together for the city of Cashmere's power system, there isn't any action required on this, but we wanted to bring it to your attention. Actually, real estate, Vicki and Becky wanted me to include this in our presentation because this is an action that's going to be taken that is planned and prescripted in the contract. But as we built Cashmere substation, so through the acquisition of this power system, there were three substations that used to be called Jarvis. We rebuilt that to standard 28 and changed the voltage. And then there was Simmer substation and Blue Star substation. Simmer substation still in operation. It's a little bit closer to the river. Blue Star substation is right by Blue Star Growers. So according to the agreement, as we showed them what our 20-year plan was, and as we no longer needed these substation facilities because they were the older voltage and they were really quite small, that those properties, the property would revert back to the city of Cashmere, who then would refer it to the adjacent property owner. That was the spirit of the agreement. So we just wanted to point out, if I got that right, we just wanted to point out that we will be transferring this property here, that used to be Blue Star Substation, and it's it's quite small. It's a little pocket substation, 50 feet by 100 feet at the most, somewhere right in there. So the idea here is that this would then go back to Blue Star Growers via the transfer to the city of Cashmere. So I just wanted to bring that to your attention.
Okay, so some upcoming actions. As we mentioned, there's no action today requested, but we just wanted to give you a heads up. So with the OMI substation, we talked about the need to acquire that additional 40 foot to the north and do that work up there. So we'll bring in we're seeking a purchase and sales agreement with an April 1st resolution on that station. Wenatchee substation, as I mentioned, we did secure the property under a purchase and sales agreement with the anticipated closing of June 1st. And so we will be formalizing that through a resolution to you at sometime between now and then, hopefully sooner than later.
Wanted to point out that those purchase and sale agreements are subject to a number of things, including board approval, right? So we won't actually accept or ratify the purchase until all of those contingencies, environmental review, properties review, a number of things. So I just wanted to point that out.
So the Mill Pond or the Smilt Creek property, again, we're continuing to evaluate our purchase options there, and we hope to have some resolution to that those options within the next month. The Chelan's Dam substation, for lack of a better name at this point, Again, we performed our outreach. We're continuing that outreach discussion. We're continuing to have conversations with stakeholders to make sure that we clearly understand expectations there. But we'd like to finalize on that. In a perfect world, we wouldn't have to bring a resolution forward to you because we actually own the property, but we certainly want to know that you support building a substation there and a corresponding transmission line. So we do have some work to do there, but things are looking good. I do want to just take this opportunity to say that although Chad and I may be the face of these acquisitions and what's going on with these substations, there's a tremendous amount of work and effort going on behind the scenes of staff to help us with that. And it's somewhat of a dynamic environment because we're actually capitalizing on opportunities of properties available as well. So we tend to shift gears week to week and day to day with these things. So staff has done just a fantastic job. In particular, I just want to mention Becky Jaspers and Vicky Griffin in our properties area. They're taking our wish lists and converting it into risk adverse agreements and protecting the district's interests from a properties and a lands management standpoint. And I also want to just recognize our legal team, of course, Eric Walquist and Karen Wiggum have been doing a tremendous amount of work in support of this as well. And Charles, of course, right? So we are very thankful for that support from staff, and we also just want to say thank you for your willingness to allow us to kind of go out in this little bit of an uncharted territory. We know that we have your support, but we very much appreciate your support. And whatever we can do on a move-forward basis to help keep you informed and give you the confidence that we're doing the right thing for the growth and expansion plans, please don't hesitate to get that information or those requests to us.
It's been nice to just track the outreach up in the Chelan area and get the initial feedback. That's just really good to see.
Yeah, thank you. Jenna Ran, our customer outreach specialist, she piloted a feedback mechanism that was pretty unique to me, but it was an opportunity for anybody there to kind of vote, if you will. I mean, we didn't really have a vote, but we had some specific questions about their level of understanding, their level of support, and people could do that anonymously right on their smartphones. We were able to share on the screen the results of that so people could see exactly where they stood relative to the other stakeholders. And it was fantastic. A really, really nice way to get feedback as well. I would just mention too that the drop-in concept of having it wasn't an open house, it was just a drop-in. It was in the Chamber of Commerce space. Right. We just had a couple of boards showing kind of the substation transmission lines in one area. The other area just had the fire resiliency project, having a couple of engineers there from transmission to answer questions, and then there were a few folks to answer things on the substation. It was just a great venue, and we were surprised by the amount of people that came in to have a conversation with us. Our outreach specialist developed some fact sheets. It was a really nice venue.
Yeah, I was going to say that as well. It's a really great space. And it really lends itself to people just dropping in, moving through, moving around a more informal environment than having a podium up front and then seating. So that's, I think that's ideal.
Yeah, we heard that from people that came in. They'd like that.
Did we sign up for that a month out for the use of that space? How does that work?
Yes, we did sign up for it, and I would say the chamber director, and I apologize, I cannot recall his name.
Lester Cooper.
Yeah. I'm sorry?
Lester Cooper?
Yeah, Lester Cooper. He was there prior to, met us there, and stayed throughout the majority of the venue, but encouraged the PUD to utilize that space on a forward basis. Yeah, so we were really happy about that. I didn't realize until I went up there and saw that the PUD sponsored a wall there. Mm-hmm. I don't know who designed that. I suspect that Kimberly Craig had her hands in that, but it was a fantastic just way to connect with the community. Mm-hmm. So I anticipate using that space more and more.
It's a good space. So great presentation in my eyes, but I just wanted to ask a question. You made a comment about the contracts minimizing risk, your whole approach. Do you see yourself taking an additional risk by offering this commission something to decide on April Fool's Day?
If Steve would give us the go-ahead to do that, I'm all...
I'm going to be gone that day.
But we'll see you on April Fool's Day.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, just thank to you. Highlight to a couple of presentations down the road related to this, we've got another quarterly load update that ties all this stuff together. It helps put into context the priorities of these sites that we're trying to identify and secure, and community outreach is all related to that load growth, which affects reliability. The other presentation that we want to put together is related to the mobile substations and our build schedule that ties in how we're prioritizing and how we think we're going to schedule each one of these substation builds over the next 5 years, and choices and risks around that. So look forward to in the next month bringing that to you all also. That helps to try to tie all this stuff together. So thank you.
Great. Good presentation. Thanks, guys. Thank you.
I could just point out one of the things. So we also have talked about the our planning looks forward to that we may be back in the borrowing market by that 2022 timeframe, somewhere around there. If we do well, then we may not need to. But if we did need to borrow, just say that the philosophy of best for the most for the longest, you can now see it being implemented here. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about things that are great value well down the road. Right. And borrowing would certainly be a fair thing to do and an equitable thing to do when you're considering some of the types of investments that we're making here. I think this all fits together in terms of where we're going with our financials as well. With that, we're going to now talk about financial resiliency. And Kelly Boyd's going to present. Despite the fact that she's wearing purple, we will not talk about the Pac-12 championship.
They both made it in the tournament. So.
Well, actually, this is a tie to the presentation also, because I had that thought this morning when I chose this color. And it is a sign of personal resiliency to be able to bounce back after those two tough losses to the green team. I am trying to be resilient with my support of my UW Huskies. So, it's a very nice segue into our update.
You just couldn't change colors from high school.
No, I liked purple for a long time. That's right. And so for the record, I am Kelly Boyd, Chief Financial and Risk Officer. And this also is a nice connection to the substation update, because that really talks a lot about things we're doing to improve resiliency in operations. And I'd like to give an update on our financial resiliency. And, just that generic definition of resiliency is the ability to recover from or adjust easily to misfortune or change. That's what I'm saying. Those basketball games were misfortune the last couple weeks. But equating that to financial, our financial resiliency is really the ability to weather the storm during the down financial times. And as part of our financial planning, we do a lot of what if scenario planning of what if it was a good outcome, what if it was a bad outcome, what are the types of things we would do in those different situations. So today's scenario to focus on is, what if we had a scenario where there were consecutive years with low revenue outcomes? And this is just a preview and an update on this, because we presented this type of thing before as it related to our debt philosophy. So no action is required today, but we also wanted to give this highlight because we'll be sharing this information as part of our long-term rate planning topic team for the strategic planning effort. So the assumptions that we use in this what if is, what if we had low water every year and we use 82% of average? And what if prices were low in every one of those years and we assume $20 a megawatt hour prices? Now, that's not a normal relationship because usually when quantities are low, prices are higher. But that's not always true, and that's not what we've seen in the last few years. But it does show indications of what we may be seeing in the future. So again, this is just a what if, and we are choosing assumptions that result in a low revenue scenario.
Kelly, you said low water years. What's the projection of low water? I mean, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, forever.
So when we do
Your forecast,
when we do a forecast of what do we expect the outcome to be?
Yeah,
we use average water because over the long term, average is what the it evens out to be. Okay. But for this scenario, we're using the 82% water, which is lower than average water, mm-hmm. and we're using that every single year.
For how many?
Through 2027 is what the forecast looks like. Sorry about that.
Thanks. No.
So,
that.
So we're applying all these assumptions to all of the years through 2027. And then same on the revenue side of things. Also on the cost side, we're assuming in what if costs were higher, and we added 5% to the capital forecast. So we already know we have a pretty aggressive capital forecast. In our expected case, and we bump that up 5% each year, as well as in our O&M costs, we bump that up 5% each year. So as you can tell by those assumptions, that these would be challenging years, and then they would compound if they happened every single year. So and based on those assumptions, we would be below our financial metrics in about a three-year time frame. So they compound on each other. And have us needing to take actions in just a few years, if that would be the case. But we have lots of tools in our toolbox to take action, especially in this kind of scenario. And our really key actions we can take, our key tools, are cost containment, debt financing for a portion of that capital. You know, in our expected case, we had been assuming pay-as-you-go capital. So we have choices to make about debt financing. And then also around electric rate increases. So back in June of 2017, we did this same kind of what if scenario, asking ourselves, what would we do if that was the case of those many consecutive years of poor financial results? And at that time, based on that information, the key actions we would take is we would limit our O&M increases to just the forecasted growth. So where I talked about we assumed that costs were higher every year by 5%, our first action would say, well, we would need to contain those costs to only the forecasted costs. And that's still a growth each year, averages out over time about just over 4%. So it's not saying no growth, it's just saying limited growth. And then we would also limit the capital increases to the existing forecast. So again, that 5% adder, we would need to contain costs to not have that and adhere to our existing forecast. And this was at the time of 2017. And then our next tool would be, instead of pay-as-you-go, we would assume that we would issue debt for about 50% of the capital plans. And using those items first, cost containment and debt issues for half of the capital plans, we would have needed an annual electric rate increase of 5% every year during that time frame through to 2027 in order to meet our financial metrics. But the combinations of those actions did help us meet our financial metrics, including a debt service coverage amount above 125. And I did want to highlight this one a little bit because these are unusual outcomes, you know, this many consecutive years with all of those low contributors to financial results. And just like when you go to borrow because you have a need in your personal life, you go to borrow from the bank, when you need to borrow the money is the hardest time to get the money because you don't really have the good look on paper to show that you can pay that back easily. That's the same for us at the district. So when we're in these unusual cases, we do have a minimum debt service coverage that's required by our bond covenants that we need to maintain before we can issue additional debt. So it's not that 2.0 that we talk about because that's what we want to achieve under expected scenarios, but we need a 1.25 to be able to issue additional debt. So that's why that one's a really critical one when we look at this is we need to maintain that because we need to maintain the ability to issue debt into the future. So this was the scenario in 2017. So all of those tools and the supplement of a 5% annual electric rate increase. Let's look at that based on what we see now. So based on our current forecast and using those same assumptions, and we did use the December 31st forecast, 2018, what steps would we need to take now in order to maintain our financial metrics through that time period of 2027? We would need to take many of the same actions, which would be to limit our O&M increases just to forecasted growth. And over time, our forecasted growth is about the same as it was in 2017. And we would also need to limit our capital increases to the existing forecast. Our forecast has increased since 2017 on capital, but we have that reflected in this. And so we would just need to cost contain to not have the additional 5% under the assumption. We would issue new external debt for about half of the capital plans, so that assumption would be part of this. And with all of those actions, then we would need a 3% annual rate increase through every year through 2027 to help us maintain our required financial metrics through that time. So 5% was the amount in 2017, 3% is the estimated amount now. And when you think about it, it kind of passes that reasonableness test because we've had both those years, 2017 and 2018, were better than budgeted results. We had the deferred contract charge that we received from our cost plus power contract. So that put us in a better cash position to start with. So we're in a better position as we start now. And so having a lower rate increase needed to keep us above our targets kind of meets that reasonableness test. So I do want to kind of pause here to see that this makes sense as we talk about this. So, you know, what if we had consecutive bad years? We have tools that we would be able to respond and maintain our metrics. One of those tools is an annual electric rate increase, and it's a little bit smaller now than it was when we did this exercise back in 2017.
One of the criteria that is, I don't see in here, I just want to make sure I'm clear. This is projected based on starting in 2020?
So the all of these apply to 2020 yeah. through 2027. Okay. Yep. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. All the consecutive years.
Mm-hmm. Kelly, on the cost forecast, do those numbers include inflationary bump?
Yes, they do. They include both times when the increase in cost isn't dependent upon inflation, where there's like a known maybe cycle of things that need to be done. Those estimates are in there. And then for the cost items that are really driven by inflation, we have a estimate in there for inflation. So we have a number of ways that we estimate the future cost.
You know, what inflationary estimate are you?
Yeah, I think on average we're using a little over 2.5%.
Thank you.
So another natural question that might come out of looking at this type of scenario would be, well, what if we waited a little longer before we did a rate increase? What would be the impact of waiting? So the next scenario is, what if we did delay that rate increase and didn't start until 2024, but we held all other assumptions the same? So with that, we would still need to take all the other steps, but we would need to do a 10% annual electric rate increase if we waited until 2024 to begin that portion of it in order to get us to the same spot at the end of 2027. So that really does show, you know, going from a 3%, if you start early and do a little along the way, compared to if you wait until later, you need a much larger rate increase to kind of catch up to where you need to be. So this is just that illustration, because I really do think that's a normal place to go as we think about things we would do is what if we waited. So with that, here comes the really exciting part. So we also wanted to show this look-through picture. This is our liquidity forecast that we use quite a bit, so we feel kind of connected to. But this is the, let's put that scenario in, look at this, and let's start with, this is what that line looks like in that low revenue scenario. You can see how fast things drop when you have a consecutive years, assuming all of those really low financial outcomes. And so you can see that we do fall pretty quickly below our green line here, which is the liquidity line. But as we think about our key tools to do that, the first one was, what if we contain both capital and O&M to the forecasted amounts only? So when we do that, you see the dotted orange line. And that does help the liquidity, because this is focusing on the liquidity metric. But it doesn't get there all by itself. So next, let's add the 50% financing for capital so that we're not paying for all of it as we go, but we're paying for some. Well, that takes us to the blue dashed line. So this has a much bigger impact than the cost containment, as you can see, but it's still not enough to keep us above our target all the way through 2027. So when we add the 3% electric rate increase each year, you see we get the solid purple line. And the combination of all of these actions is what keeps us above our liquidity target and as well as our other key financial metrics. And then that one more look that we said of what if we waited until 2024 to apply a rate increase. If we do that and it's the 10%, we get the red line. That also gets us to that same spot out here in 2027, but that was the double-digit rate increase as opposed to a small one over time. And that's what it takes for us to get there and shows kind of the steps along the way that each action contributes to that. So Brett Hammond, I don't know, I can't see him in the audience, I wanted to give him credit for the cool graphic presentation there to walk us through that, because I tend to just plop all those lines on the graph and there's a lot of information there that makes it hard to connect to. So I thought that was a really great way to through the graphic to help us walk through the steps that we have to keep us financially resilient. And that does just lead to our key takeaways from the presentation of we are financially resilient. We have tools in the toolbox that even in consecutive low revenue scenarios, our tools of controlling costs, issuing debt, and small rate increases can be combined to maintain our necessary financial metrics. And it does show that small incremental rate increases over time help avoid larger increases by waiting until later, even in those low revenue scenarios. So all of this together is one of those messages that we'll be sharing in our long-term rate planning topic team session that's coming up here on March 8th. 20. Or March 28th. Sorry about that. Thank you. So are there any questions about how that all fits together? All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Kelly. A lot of work went into this presentation. Thank you.
You bet. Thank you.
Commissioners, if you're willing, we've got some time. I'd like to suggest we take some manager items so we can move through some of the afternoon session. Is that okay with you? I want to start with Justin Erickson, just talking about upcoming strategic planning presentations, topic team updates, and then also he's managing the Rock Island Early Action Credit Team. team, and they've had a meeting to do a summary of that.
Good morning, Commissioners. Justin Erickson, Managing Director of District Services. I will start with a general update on strategic planning overall. Since your last meeting of March 4th, there were two topic team meetings. On March 7th, the Rock Island Relicensing Team met, and I'll provide that update momentarily. And on March 14th, the Public Power Benefit Team met as well, and Mike will also provide that update momentarily. Looking ahead, as Kelly mentioned, the long-term rate planning topic team meets on March 28th. Ironically, March 28th was a popular meeting date. It seemed to work for a lot of topic teams, and so that the Public Power Benefit Team will also meet that day, along with Rock Island Relicensing. So we have three teams meeting. There is a slight difference in the times for those meetings. We did also review, because we know that there are members of teams that serve on multiple teams, to see if there were any major conflicts. And there does not appear to be, and that's because there are team members that can provide additional coverage. So, for example, we've been very engaged with the Malaga Community Council, who and they have members serving on multiple teams. And so they'll be able to participate accordingly. So I did want you to know that we do have those three meetings on March 28th. And despite the fact that it might seem like there's some conflict there, I think that it will go off well. I wanted to update you also on the survey that you were provided an update on at the last meeting. As of Friday, we have had 443 responses to that survey. So we're meeting that expected metric to get a scientifically valid sample. That said, we have decided to extend the survey a couple more days into early this week. So that will be wrapping up, and then we'll be able to look at preliminary data. So that is going well. This is all headed towards a process, as you know, of going in May to all of the customer owners with a survey and public education instrument. So we are already working on that internally and meeting on that this week. You might recall during the last effort, there was an exercise with coins that was fairly popular. We're hoping to adapt that to this process. It may be amended somewhat, but we're working through that now, and we hope to provide you a preview of those materials in late April. Lastly, Commissioner Bowles, you mentioned you inquired at the last meeting about any themes, early impressions so far, and because not all of the topic teams have met, I think it's probably still just a bit premature to note those, but I should have a well-reasoned note for you probably at your April 1st meeting. So thank you for bearing with me on that. Any questions on where we're at? I might also mention that as part of that effort in May, going to all the customer owners, we'll be releasing additional digital video content that we are currently scripting as well. So that's part of our outreach efforts. That content will also be available in Spanish. Okay. Thank you. I'll shift gears now and talk about Rock Island Relicensing and our topic team meeting that we held on March 7th. We had a really engaged group. I think we had nearly every member of the team present, so that was about 14 people or so that were there. One of the things that we started with was going through a list of pros and cons relative to early action. And some of the thoughts, what I'll do is just kind of summarize things for you in the interest of time. But the pros are probably not going to be much of a surprise to you, but the group felt obviously that there was early benefits to pursuing early actions, and that there'd be some recreational benefits in particular that would occur approximately 9 or 10 years in advance, which were quite exciting to them. Also felt like there was some value in addressing relicensing matters early, kind of known issues early. And also it provided an opportunity to take advantage of other projects or partnerships that are currently happening in the community. So from that perspective, there could be some advantage in terms of timing should there be other efforts that we're able to take on to. Some of the cons that were identified included the potential to invest in projects that perhaps may not be required if we were just to go through the standard relicensing process. So There could be a risk there of going above and beyond. And so look forward to kind of working through that with the group and ultimately with you. Other noted cons, taking early action may not have the full breadth of stakeholder involvement. So we know that relicensing process is complicated and in-depth and a multi-year process. And there's extensive stakeholder outreach. Early actions would be have a reduced standard in terms of stakeholder involvement. It would still be significant, but it would not be the same. And so there is some risk there that the topic team noted. And lastly, the process is untested. So we know that we will be likely the first or one of the first to go through this process. And so there may be a variety of just unknown unknowns out there that we would face. We then shifted gears and started talking about, well, if we're going to consider early actions, what are some potential criteria that we should test those proposals on? And we identified kind of three buckets of criteria. The first bucket is the FERC criteria. So we know that there's got to have project nexus. We've got a project boundary that we have to ensure is met. And then there's FERC criteria for early action and a pre-approval process before, of course, a full amendment that would be approved by FERC. Then we know that there's PUD-specific criteria, so any actions have to be within our legislative authority. We're going to go through our well-reasoned process of assessing risks and financial and economic analysis. Ultimately, it would also have to be approved by you. And so those two buckets were fairly easy to come up with. And as staff, we kind of led that discussion. And then we turned it over to the group to talk about what are some customer owner project criteria that they would want to test these projects under. And I'll just highlight a few. It was really good discussion. Some of the things that were noted, the ability to potentially complement or leverage existing plans and programs, efforts. This kind of speaks to that partnership issue that I mentioned earlier. That was noted. Also, the broader economic and community benefits of the proposed enhancement, a realization of those benefits. Another criteria was noted was the ability to provide access in areas that are currently underserved. So particularly in areas like Malaga, like Rock Island, where there's limited public access to the Columbia River. And lastly, the ability to promote environmental and cultural benefits. So we looked at a variety of environmental, cultural benefits. All told, it was probably about 7 or 8 criteria that were identified in addition in this third pot that I mentioned. And so over the coming meetings with the team, we'll be refining those. We'll be testing a specific list of projects against those criteria as we look to formulate a specific recommendation and formulate our approach as we go to all customer owners in May. I did want to conclude, though, just so that you had an idea on some of the initial projects that were mentioned by the group. I'll just highlight a few. We had a large representation from the Malaga Community Council that was present. I think 4 or 5 community council members were there. They are interested in access to the Columbia River, some type of boat launch, park, beach area, potentially also some area for sports and field play. The city of Rock Island had a similar request, and Mayor Agnew was there. Representing the city of Rock Island. There was a fair amount of discussion about the loop trail and about the potential for trail extensions. Not necessarily a particular route, but just in general, the desire to evaluate the existing trail and if they're and what the feasibility is to extend that trail either on the east or west side of the river. The Haran Natural Area came up multiple times in different contexts. Provides obviously an opportunity to have natural interpretive use, which was mentioned by the Audubon Society. We had a representative there. Also, it could provide an opportunity to provide better access to the Wenatchee River, which was also mentioned by one or more participants. And then there's a cultural aspect to the Haran area as well. And last thing I would highlight is there was, a really good understanding from the group about the historical and cultural significance of Rock Island itself, Rock Island Dam itself. And so there was some discussion about how can we also recognize that value, not necessarily in some major project or an expensive way, but just in a historical and culturally appropriate way. So I thought that was interesting to note as well. Are there any questions about what I mentioned, and any concerns about where we're headed with the topic team? All right. Well, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank good, you. Good presentation.
Next up, Mike Coleman's going to talk about the public power benefit topic team.
Mike Coleman, Managing Director of Fiber and Telecom. I started just to come on up with Justin, and I wish I had now. We recognized early on that there were some linkages and interdependencies between the early action topic team and the public power benefit. After listening to Justin, I would have to tell you that the public power benefit topic team members evidently came with the same mindset as the early action committee did. First, I'm going to thank Ann for recommending Mary Murphy. She was not able to make the first meeting, but she did make the meeting last week on the 14th. And she had prepared for herself a document that related to the criteria. And I thought it was A, excellent. B, I saw a very strong linkage between that document and the decision evaluation criteria that we use internally here. And so she talked about and subsequently sent me the document the next day about meeting the statute, our financial parameters and eligibility requirements, specifically talked about the looking at the community benefit to everything that we do, not only how much of the population does it impact, but does it cut across the socioeconomic ages, abilities, et cetera. And then went on to talk about the priorities of the PUD, particularly the timing or the urgency of the activity and how it supports our priorities, the fact that we have to be flexible, and then specifically keyed in on partnerships and the fact that we do not have to do everything ourselves, that there are partners, and in many cases, the best way to achieve an objective is to work with a partner and make sure the partner is fully committed and capable of doing a particular activity. And then last, for this session, long-term sustainability and looking at the level of preparedness that we have to implement a specific activity. Where they ultimately went sounded very much like Justin's list. Rather than focusing on key projects, They talked about things that we should prioritize in every project that we do. Specifically, that came to the top was access to the water, access to the river. That's important to the customer owners as a whole. Environmental stewardship, which goes directly to the many, many things we do in that area. Being aware of both the cultural and inclusiveness and diversity and the multicultural aspects of everything that we do. Again, the partnerships and also the history of the PUD, the valley, and the region. So it kind of ties all of those things together. But they would also like to see it overlaid with some of the other priorities. One of them is, of course, education. How do we make sure that everything we do, every activity, every initiative, every project incorporates the aspects and the elements that can be applied to the education? Second thing was job readiness. What can we do with our projects and initiatives that enhances not only the educational quality, but job readiness? How do we expose the community to the many jobs and the things that we do within the PUD? And then last, and certainly not least, is the fact that every project or initiative could have an economic development aspect. Even though we can't do economic development activities directly, many, many of the things that we do do has an economic development aspect to it and brings value to the county. One of the specific examples that was talked about in the meeting, we have a lot of sculptures in our parks from Art on the Avenue. And so an idea was that if we put a QR code on that sculpture, the base of it, then somebody with a smartphone can click on the QR code, instantly get a narrative, bilingual narrative, that would explain both what the sculpture is, the historical significance, the cultural significance, and what it ties to in the valley. So I walked away from the meeting feeling, A, very, very good about it. I was extremely, I'll say, happy with the tone of the conversation and the desire of the conversation to approach things holistically and not look at individual projects as just standalone, that we need to consider all aspects of it.
How many community members came?
We ended up with six. Another one got sick that morning. We have another four or five that were not able to make this particular meeting, but we are keeping them in the loop, sharing the discussion, the notes, and the documents with them so that they can still provide their input. We have several others that told us up front they would not be able to attend the meetings, but they did want to stay informed, and so we're sharing the same information with them.
Hmm. What did you send out as preliminary materials? I'm curious, Mike, to the members.
I'm going to go back to meeting one, and we had shared the original kickoff presentation. Plus, we shared some additional information. We had Kelly there to present on the financials and Eric to present on the statutory limitations, express and implied authorities. This time, we had pre-shared the notes from the first meeting, plus shared a couple of additional documents that came out of the first meeting, and teed up the questions that we wanted to address this time. And specifically, those questions were, what activities should we focus on, and how should we prioritize those activities? So in the meeting, and I teed it up, that we generally see the top three always are fiber, education, and parks and recreation. And that I would really encourage some broad thinking, some creative thinking as to what is going to be important to the county in the next 5 years, the next 10 years. And so as part of that, we shared a number of documents in the meeting. In addition to Mary talking about her criteria, we shared a flow chart that starts with the question, is it possible? And then you can go through your different yes and no's, and you can look at it and say, if it's not possible, can it be made possible? Can we change the scope? Can we shrink the scope? Can we enlarge the scope to make it something that's possible? Secondarily, we also had shared the project worksheet from the early action topic team, which went through and matches the express and implied authority questions that we had previously shared. So it tied the two teams together, and it caused them to look at it from a perspective of, can we meet the express and implied authority questions in order to say that something is feasible?
Mm-hmm. Is it possible to get for us to get those session notes to see those?
Absolutely. I'll be more than happy to do it.
Yeah, great. That'd be helpful. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, Mary is, that's why I recommended Mary. You know she's going to do her homework and come well prepared.
She told me that up front. She made a believer out of it. Any other questions?
Sounds terrific.
Okay. Thank you.
Good progress. Thank you.
I'd like to invite Felicity Saberhagen and Sharon Turcotte to come up, and I think they have a couple of special guests, too.
We changed the people coming up today. So Felicity Saberhagen, business advisor. And with me today, I have Jennifer White and Tamara Burns. And I'll explain to you why I brought them up today in just a minute here. This is an update on the public power benefit project that we have to provide an internship opportunity for an intellectually developmentally disabled staff person. We were able to do that through an office aide. We had many people that supported us through this process, so that's why I wanted to bring everyone up today. And got some news this morning about it that is really cool that I really wanted Jennifer to be able to share. In carrying out our vision for the best, for the most, for the longest, it's important that Chelan PUD does represent our employees represent the community that we serve. And that was a big driver for putting this program forward. We don't have any intellectually developmentally disabled staff at this time, and now we do. We had one start today, so it's a wonderful opportunity for her. In pursuing this, there were many, many people that were involved, many agencies, and lots of work that went into it. Specifically, I wanted to have Jennifer share the experience and Tamara as well in terms of what this means. We had some news today that is Sharon and I didn't know about, and it's really interesting, and I think you'll enjoy hearing about it. So with that, I would like to turn it over to Jennifer. Thank you.
My long self. Great. Thank you so much for having us today. We're very excited to be working with the PUD, and like Felicity mentioned, it's been a real village to get this up off the ground. I especially want to thank Sharon Turcotte and Ruth for their dedication to continue to have this conversation until they found the right plug to work this into the PUD. So I own a company called Able Opportunities. I'm hired by Tamara Burns, who is the Chelan-Douglas County DD coordinator, who supports all of the agencies who support people with disabilities in jobs, specifically folks with intellectual developmental disabilities. So we've been brainstorming. We started meeting, I think, Tamara, you met with the PUD 5 years ago. And then, like I said, Sharon and Ruth provided a way to step into this with an internship. The design is specifically created to be very business-minded. Like I said, I own a company called Able Opportunities. I contract around the country. I'm a subject matter expert for the Department of Labor. I help states integrate projects that are in alignment with WIOA. I'm looking at the lawyer knowing that WIOA is right, the Workforce Investment and Innovation and Opportunity Act. We've worked really for decades to level the playing field for people with cognitive disabilities to access really good jobs. And we've been inventors in the process of doing that. We invented an app that allows somebody to capture, track, and report to their own employer. Some of the statistics will tell you that the reason this isn't really working well across the nation yet is because the support agency, like my agency, works so hard to make sure that that person is doing well that we stand between the boss and the employee. So we've invented ways to really shift that, to move into alliance, to build the right bridge. So you're going to see a lot of accommodation tools for Sydney, your new employee, but also for you. So some of the things that we want to make sure you already know that you already have, Sharon has access to. We have a PowerPoint that puts together your values, what this internship and this project will look like over the next couple of months. We're making some film to capture stories so that you can tell that story. But most significantly, we're capturing the cost analysis and return on investment for you, because one of the biggest injuries in our field is that we've built a capacity model. We come begging at the door, we'll do any job, please let us in. When in fact, Sydney is going to be saving you money. There's going to be a more efficient way of doing the flow of business, taking off tasks that are more rote, repetitive, that get put to the side that might not get done, or you're paying somebody who's cross-trained to do it now, and she's not going to be paid at that salary rate, so that you could set a model that is significantly different than what is, exists right now. And the exciting news that Felicity wanted me to share is that I, as a subject matter expert for the Department of Labor, I got to present to their departments, and the Department of Justice was very excited about these tools and came back to us and asked us to present to Congress in the follow-up report from the National Council on Disability. So these very tools that people are starting to understand are necessary are going to be modeled here at the PUD. So the potential for some very strong PR is very, we're capturing stories right from the beginning in these cost analysis documents right from the beginning, so that you have the potential to tell that story to the world. First the PUD, then the world. Anything that, do you have any questions about that? And I know I spoke, we just speak for expediency. I kind of, instead of letting Tamara do the initial intro of what we did, because we're here because, you know, Tamara and Sharon and Ruth came up with this idea and started having conversations. And then I know internally you all worked hard to get it into play. Any specific questions?
Oh, I just have to say I am so thrilled. This is something that 10 years ago, I felt we should do. I didn't have a vision of what it could look like. I mean, this far supersedes what I thought we could do. But I knew it was something I wanted to do. I thought we wanted to do it. It was something we should do. I saw other groups in the community doing this, working with DD and you know, developmentally disabled employees, and they all found a niche. They were able to find a niche that worked, like you described, the rote work or the work that, you know, we might have to cross, I forget the term you use.
Cross-training.
Yeah, that it was just the right niche. And so I am just so thrilled. Excellent. Thank you.
We're glad to be here. Thanks for your work to get us in the door.
One of the other things I wanted to mention, too, that Jennifer didn't maybe talked about a little bit, but this was a competitive opportunity. So not only did the employee today get an opportunity to participate in it, we had two other employees that were able to interview through this process, which is phenomenal to be able to do that. This, as Mike mentioned earlier, we try and seek partnership opportunities where we have fully capable partners to be able to support the programs that we put in place, and this is one example of them that has worked out phenomenally well.
We wrote it. I just want to add one more thing. We wrote a standard operating procedure at Able Opportunities for a company to be able to maintain ownership and management of this without having to become an expert about working with someone with Down syndrome or autism or something like that. That really allows the employer to stay in place and strengthen this relationship. And the PUD is actually, we've got parts of it in different companies, but we're going to roll this out completely for the first time here.
Hmm. Wow.
Yeah. We didn't let you say a word.
Yeah, absolutely support this all the way through, and had a wonderful conversation yesterday with employees, and just cannot tell you how happy I am. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yep.
Great opportunity.
Thank you. We know it's the right thing. We want to show you it's the smart thing, too. So by the end of this, you're going to have some good math to break those myths.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you.
And thanks to Commissioner Congdon for being such a strong advocate for that.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
With that, I think we are good to take the lunch break.
Okay. I want to thank everyone this morning that presented. We're a really great morning, good presentations. And with that, we're going to recess for lunch. We'll see you this afternoon. Good afternoon, and welcome to the March 18th, 2019 business session of the Chelan County Public Utility District. I'd like to remind everyone to please silence any electronic devices that you may have with you today. And welcome all of our visitors. We place great value on the public input at our meetings, and since these meetings are recorded, if you wish to address any items on the agenda, please step forward, state your name, address, speak clearly into the microphone, and please limit your comments to 3 minutes. Commissioners, this afternoon we have before us a consent agenda. Is there any motion to accept such consent agenda?
I move acceptance of the consent agenda as amended this morning, which places Resolution 8 on the regular agenda and Resolutions 10 and 11 onto the consent agenda.
Second. Been moved and seconded. Is there any discussion? Hearing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed say nay. The ayes have it. So we'll move on to our regular agenda. Steve, would you like to take that on?
Yeah, I think we'll start with agenda item 8, then a resolution ratifying field work orders numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, authorizing final acceptance of work performed under bid number 17-83 with Colvaco Incorporated of Spokane, Washington. Tom Beebe will present. Tom, welcome.
Welcome. Good afternoon, commissioners. I'm Tom Beebe. I was a project manager for Project 1783, which was the Rocky Reach fire alarm system upgrades. Here today for final acceptance of that project and ratify field work orders change orders number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. So give you a little rundown real quick on those field work order change orders, and if you have any questions, we'll go from there. So field work order change order number 1, that was to purchase 4 additional generator smoke detectors for unit C8 through C11. Part of the project was to purchase basically units 1 through 7 upon issuance of this project. We discovered that the additional units 8 through 11 already had outdated smoke detectors in them. They've been basically discontinued by the manufacturer. So it was the plant's recommendation that we have similar smoke detectors amongst the units for the same manufacturer. So we went ahead and procured 4 new smoke detectors for basically units C8 through C11, the large units at Rocky Reach. And plant's in the process of installing those as we speak. So, and then field work order change order number 2 was for interfacing the fire alarm system with the new bulk electric system. So in the event of a fire, basically all the new card readers, access doors, those doors would unmagnetize and allow members of the public to escape basically those automatic doors in the powerhouse. So that was the interface to what George installed earlier this year as well out at Rocky Reach. And then the field work order change order number 3, that was the Rocky Reach control room, FM200 clean agent, fire extinguisher system, tank relocation. So originally we had the tanks in the basically control room. Due to the space and the needs of the plant, they wanted to move those outside of the control room, so they were moved outside of the control room to the north, basically the area just north of the control room, those double doors. In doing so, we had to run a bunch of re-engineering calculations, upsize the tanks, come up with a different system. In doing so, we have longer pipe runs, and that's the cost associated with that change of relocating those tanks. They also included some nitrogen booster tanks, which really kind of drove that cost up. That was for future space needs in the control room. They had different areas allocated they wanted to basically keep open, so they wanted to get those tanks out of there, and that's what we did. And then field work order change order number 4 was a combination of 3 different activities. Basically, this was additional conduit for the 4th floor smoke detectors. So we went through and replaced all these smoke detectors on the floor. Once we got in there above the basically drop-down ceiling, we found out that it was a non-NEC compliant installation. So we paid the contractor to make it up to NEC codes for the conference rooms, that area in the 4th floor of the powerhouse. And then lastly, there's a project being put together right now that's for the clean and dirty oil room fire suppression system. We wanted future provisions in there, so when that new system got installed, it would talk to the new fire control panel that we put in the control room. So basically the contractor put in a bunch of monitor modules, and we'll be able to accept the signals from the new fire suppression system, the flow switches, at a later date. So if there is a fire event in basically the clean or dirty oil room, we will get notification in the control room that those flow switches have been activated. And the last item on here was the incident last June. We had a kind of safety stand down day. There was some contractor basically cost associated with rentals and such, not that they didn't show up that day, so we just gave them a little bit of money for that. And then contractor for field work order change order number 6 was late 12 days on substantial completion. So they were assessed LDs for this project. So they were roughly $1,000 a day for that 12 days of late completion. So that's kind of what I had for field work orders, change orders 1 through 6, and kind of the upgrades we did to the fire alarm system at Rocky Reach, the FM200 system in the control room, and also the new installation for the Discovery Center out there. Any questions?
pictures. Any questions?
Okay.
Very good. Thank you.
Yep, thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
Okay. So we have Agenda 9. Of course, Agenda 9 was discussed previously, but I'll read it anyway. And Heather Ireland will be here to answer any questions you might have. This is the resolution authorizing a loan from the financing facility system to the Rock Island system in an amount not to exceed $87 million to finance certain Rock Island capital improvements for 2019 and 2020. Heather, do you have any new information for the board?
I don't have any new information to add, just what we discussed a couple weeks ago when we talked about the proposed internal loan between the systems. But I'd like to open it up if there's any questions.
I think that means Heather did a good job the last year.
That's right. I think so.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you.
Well, I was banking on the fact that we can remember that far back.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you.
And that's it for resolutions.
Okay. And did we cover all manager items?
We'll need a motion.
Or a motion. I'm sorry.
Yes. I would move approval of resolutions 8 and 9.
Second.
Second.
Been moved and seconded. Any discussion? No discussion. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it.
I would like to take a moment to recognize under manager items one of our managers. So Greg Carrington was recently honored for his service to the Northwest Hydropower Association. Take a moment to describe that. He received the Pamela E. Klatt Award. The attributes for award winners include approaches each project with a strong commitment to the balance between resource protection and resource development. Demonstrates a true appreciation for the views and responsibilities of everyone involved, demands the best work, always from themselves and others, and encourages others' professional development as a mentor and colleague. They recognized Greg's 36-year career, including work in hydro project design, relicensing, natural resource management, federal dam license implementation, and most recently overseeing power trading and planning and managing wholesale revenues. Of course, Greg has been active in industry groups and has particular interest in bringing young professionals to the hydropower industry. So nice award for him. Greg is not here today, unfortunately, so we're not able to applaud him in person. But if you get the chance, I hope you'll get take the opportunity to say something to him and recognize the work that he's done.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's a great focus on the good job that he's doing. Yeah. Great.
One other item, just want to make you aware that Suzanne Grissel and I had been working for months, actually, on a paper that we've given different titles to at various times, but it's been basically trying to lay out an agenda for the hydropower industry for how the industry could be reinvigorated, feeling that, again, the hydropower has been taken for granted in a lot of the public policy arenas. But in addition to that, there's work that the industry itself needs to do to continue to improve. We shared that, Suzanne shared it, with the National Hydropower Association board. They liked it so much that they have told us today that they want to put an NHA brand on it. So it would be an NHA Chelan branded document. Mm-hmm. Or I want to use the term roadmap because that's the way I think of it, but I've heard that it's been used in other ways. But basically to lay out an agenda for the hydropower industry for how we would continue to improve and how we would increase value for the industry. So it deals with things like the markets, public policy, needing to create parity, relicensing, but also things like our need to bring new technologies into the industry. So it's an array of issues that's all designed around how do we increase the value of hydropower in the marketplace. So I have been invited to speak at the NHA conference April 2nd. The reason I'm bringing this up, actually, is because I'll need to fly earlier than that, so I won't be here for our next board meeting in order to be able to make that presentation.
Very good. Fantastic acknowledgement. Yeah. Congratulations.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Good work. Suzanne really is amazing for
person.
Yes. I think there were a couple of amazing people working on that project.
Yeah.
So your humility is there, Steve, but you earn recognition in this along with Suzanne.
Well, thank you. Ready to move to the next item? Okay. We're done with manager
items. So.
Yep.
Next item on the agenda is commissioner items. Commissioners, do we have any items we'd like to discuss?
Just, I'd like to say, you know, Gary and I made it to Waputa last week, and we missed the rest of you. We could probably use the extra forces on the Hill when we were harassing all of our legislators about ongoing legislative battles. And I won't say we were harassing them. We were engaging them in good conversation. We really did have good conversation. So it was a good new commissioner orientation session, and I think really good session with legislature there on the Hill.
Well said.
I did call in.
Yes, you did.
Yes.
I was a little noisy, I understand. But
you quieted right down after that.
Yeah. but that works really well if you can't for some, well, I was in California, but if you can't make it for some reason. I could hear. I did have to ask, who was it? George. George, ask George to speak up a little bit. You know, one thing you might take back, Randy, for the people mm-hmm. who are calling in,
mm-hmm.
when there's a question asked and then someone responds to the question, or whoever is doing the presentation, if they could repeat the question. Because so often you can't hear the question because it's by somebody out in the audience a ways away from the speaker.
That's good feedback.
Yeah. That would be helpful. But yeah, that's a nice feature to be able to call in at times. Because I didn't want to miss the discussion on clean energy.
Right.
Primarily. Yeah.
Appreciate your recognition of my absence, Randy, but I was attending just a report to give you on the Discovery Center update. There are a lot of people working very hard to make that new Discovery Center out of Rocky Reach. In my estimation, it is just going to be, it's going to be wonderful. From the entrance to that building, just the changes that we're making in the building are going to be vastly improved and really make that facility something special where visitors, it's very appealing to get in there. But just the work that's taking place from, you know, from the First Nations history to everything about the themes running throughout the different floors of the Discovery Center, it's really going to be special. And I came out of there, out of that meeting, it was an all-day meeting, and I'm really excited about that. It's people are working really hard on that, and pretty exciting.
So will that be ready for prime time in July or not?
Mm-mm. Oh, no. This is multi-year prime.
Multi-year, okay.
Yeah.
Because I know PUD Association plans on touring Rocky Reach in July, so.
At least a couple of years.
Okay.
But we can show them what's going to happen. I don't recall when the facility closes down for upgrades. Do you?
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know where the actual, a lot of work's going to go into that building, just rehabbing the building before we move in that Discovery Center.
And just, it's not a done deal either. We need to bring that back to the board. We have work to do yet.
I think somebody may know.
Oh, so we might be the glitch here.
Yeah, Kirk Hudson, Managing Director of Generation and Transmission. And along with all that work that's being done on the conceptual design, we are updating our cost estimates too. And that's what we plan to bring back April, May timeframe. So you can get a feel for the costs that go with the project. We've brought the costs forward individually with different pieces of it, from the fish viewing windows to the roof extension, you might remember, of the visitor center. And now we're trying to package the whole thing up so you can see everything together. So we're looking at the next month.
And the fish viewing area will actually be a vital component of the Discovery Center. So it'll be more than just viewing the fish, it'll be a multi-sensory sound type thing and information about fish, and it's going to be a great educational.
Yeah. Is most of this under the umbrella of the public power benefit?
Nope. There's a significant, well, I should say, shouldn't say most of it. A big chunk of it is, but there's also a big chunk that's also within our standard operating maintenance and capital budgets. There's improvements that we needed to make regardless of what we do. Even if we decided not to do anything, we've got electrical improvements, HVAC improvements, have a pretty significant price tag associated with them.
And we wanted to get the museum out of the dam and into the
Yeah.
So the people don't have to walk all the way across the, what do you call that? The boardwalk, the walk across the dam.
The deck,
that's what you call it, yeah.
Yeah, it's not so much, it's just from a security standpoint of allowing public access to the grounds, but not necessarily unescorted access to the powerhouse itself. We would still provide access to the powerhouse with a guided tour, if you will, but just not public access completely to come and go into the powerhouse and out.
So it'll actually open up public access, in my view, more to that Discovery Center from a variety of different levels. And I came away from this last meeting, you know, that people are really working hard to make this thing a true gem. Our district.
Yeah, there is a lot of good work going into it.
So I would still encourage all of you to go visit the Discovery Center. I forget what they call it at Wanapum Dam and at Priest Rapids Dam. Wanapum is first, right? Going south?
Wanapum is the north, yeah.
Closest to us, to the north, yeah. Yep. Wanapum is a smaller space, and it's very interactive, and it would be perfect for children. I mean, it's great for adults too, but it would be the place to take your children because it's very interactive and your children. Yeah, I mean, from age 3 on up, it's fabulous. I loved it. And then we also went down and visited the First Nations, what did they call that, Steve, at Priest Rapids. First Heritage Center, I think, which is a much bigger space. It's not as interactive, but it's fascinating. They've done a really beautiful job on both of those. So it gives you an idea. And the reason we went was because we're on this committee, and Debbie wanted us to see what's possible, the potential of a smaller space. In fact, Wanapum's space is smaller than what we're going to have available for our Discovery Center. So, yeah, I'm taking my grandchildren when they're up here this summer for sure.
So we should be back in the next 4 to 6 weeks with latest cost estimates.
Thank you.
Yeah, great. Good. Good stuff. We have exciting things happening here at the district.
Next up is delegation or follow-up of delegation action.
Yeah, and I realized that I overlooked one thing that I wanted to mention, too. So last week I had the opportunity to spend the day in Olympia and met with an incredible array of leaders in both the House and Senate engaged on the clean electricity bill. And I wanted to raise it particularly because I was just really grateful to Senator Brad Hawkins, who put together a day that when we talked about it with others, they were just astounded that able to get in at that level in one day, meet with a whole bunch of folks who are right involved in the day-to-day of writing that bill. So it felt like it was a good day, good opportunity just to explain what the value of hydropower is, both historically, but even more importantly, what its future is and how it can help to support the clean energy economy. It really is the premier renewable resource, and I think showed folks some things that they didn't know about how the system operates and what the value is that hydropower brings to it, what a treasure we have in the hydropower system in Washington State. So thanks to Senator Hawkins. With that, in terms of delegation of action items, we had couple from last meeting. Heather Ireland provided information on the outstanding balances of current debt for Rock Island. I think she cut it out the same day, if I recall right.
That was impressive.
You had asked that Justin provide updates on emerging themes from strategic planning. You heard from him today, and you'll hear more as we move through the process. I still have an action item. This is on me to provide information on incremental investment analysis for the Rock Island projects. I've got all that. it's in a bit of a complex format, so I just want to simplify it some, get it to you so that it's a little easier to follow. We had an action item to bring back a description of the position for the developmentally disabled candidate. So you saw that here today. And we were going to bring back how things were going on the outreach plan for the fire risk assessment. You heard that from Andrew today. You'll hear more as we continue to move forward. And I think that's it.
Any action items for today?
Just got one, I think. So the request that Mike Coleman provide the public power benefit topic team presentation materials to the commission. So we'll get that out to you. Miss anything?
Okay. Well, I don't see any public or additional comment.
We might have a member of the public show up who wants to give public comment, and if they do, I would just suggest we need to do a short executive session. Maybe we could take a break to receive that if they do.
Okay. Matters of general business that may come before the commission, seeing none. But how much time do we need for executive
session? I think 30 minutes should do it.
So, all right. So we'll go into executive session to discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement actions, litigation, potential litigation to which the district or its board is or is likely to become a party, and or legal risks as authorized by the RCW. We'll go into executive session for 30 minutes. Do we need a break at all? No, we're good. We're going to roll right into it.
Okay.
We're coming out of executive session.
Hey, it's March 18th, 2019. No decisions were made. No votes were taken. Is there any additional business to come before the commission? Hearing none, we stand adjourned.